He was an Italian monk, a Dutch barber, also a hydraulics engineer. In London, he became a circus strongman of great renown. Because even that wasn't picaresque enough, he decided to become the greatest archaeologist the world had yet known. This man discovered the tomb of a pharaoh. He found the entrance to one of the great pyramids. He brought to light a massive temple from under the desert sands, and he gained something few people are ever cool enough to earn, an arch nemesis. He was one of the first modern archaeology adventurers, Indiana Jones with a 2-foot turban on his head and a beard to match. This is his story. War. Huh! What is it good for? Absolutely, museums. I'll say it again. Museums. At least, that's the case at the dawn of the 19th century. There were other motives for colonialism, of course, but the great treasure hunt to snatch the archaeological achievements of ancient civilizations and bring them home really was treated as important and central to the cause, rather than a fun bonus thing to plunder. 19th century high-class Europeans were really obsessed with ancient civilizations. You know that Tumblr post that's like, high-value art heists should be legal and should be a friendly international competition like Eurovision and the Olympics? That kinda really happened between European powers in the early 19th century, with fewer rules and more dead people. Napoleon, 1798. Not yet an emperor, he heads France's military forces. He wants to scuttle the expansion of the British Empire, the only European power he can't intimidate into signing a peace treaty. At this point, Egypt was sort of part of the Ottoman Empire, but also sort of independent and also sort of a British protectorate. Nation-states with clear defined borders were not the norm yet. Napoleon had yet to popularize those. Either way, Egypt in 1798 was not really part of the British Empire, but certainly not an enemy of the Brits, and the Suez Canal didn't exist yet. To get from Europe to the crown jewel of the British Empire, India, you had to go overland through Egypt. Napoleon realized Egypt was the British Empire's biggest choke point. If he invaded Egypt, he could cut off their path to India. So, in May 1798, Napoleon set sail for Egypt. Alongside his 60,000 troops travel a corps of 167 scientists. They are zoologists, archaeologists, draftsmen, historians, and more. They are the first Egyptologists of modern times. They just don't know it yet. The French fleet lands in Alexandria. They quickly defeat the Mamluks, who rule Egypt in the name of the Ottoman Empire, but the British cotton on to the invasion. The Royal Navy, led by the legendary Admiral Horatio Nelson, pursues Napoleon's fleet through the Mediterranean for 2 months, never getting close enough to engage them, until finally, he ambushes the French as they're anchored in the port of Aboukir. Soon, there is no French fleet. Napoleon's men take cover in a 15th century ruin, a fort overlooking the town of Al-Rashid. They scramble to reinforce the walls. It is then, during construction work, that they notice one broken pavement stone that's not like the others. Alongside Egypt's mysterious hieroglyphs, there's some Greek text. Did I mention what Westerners called the town beside the fort? Al-Rashid, the wise, didn't sound good to them. They called it Rosetta. And yes, that's the stone. After 2 years of fighting, the French can't hold out any longer. The British have allied against them with the Ottoman Empire, who still have plenty of troops and territory from where they can take Egypt back. As part of the settlement, the French have to turn over the antiquities they found. In 1801, the Rosetta Stone sails away to the British Museum. It's still there. The Rosetta Stone is not just the key to reading hieroglyphs, it's also the linchpin to a new Franco-British war. A war without guns. A war not for a territory, not for independence, but for things most people had never heard of. Things with strange names. Pyramids, sphinxes, sarcophagi, obelisks. A war for treasures and mysteries. A war of words and diplomacy to fill cabinets of curiosities. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, and Husalino the Capybara. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Then you leave your work behind.
Henry Salt had done everything right. Early in life, Salt had ambitions of becoming a portrait painter. At the age of 19, he moved from his hometown of Lichfield in the West Midlands to London in order to study under the greatest masters he could find. Alas, Salt doesn't have the talent to become a portrait painter. But he loves art too much. He finds the next best thing, a job as a draftsman for an aristocrat, George Annesley, the Viscount Valentia. Salt draws the landscapes and the scenes of human interest that the Viscount observes in his travels. In 1802, as the Rosetta Stone is revealed to the public at the British Museum, Salt and Valentia embark on a four-year trip. They round the Cape of Good Hope, then India and Sri Lanka. The party returns by way of Ethiopia, where they open up trade relations with England, then through Egypt. Salt does everything right. He gets on very well with these foreign rulers and warlords. He paints and draws enough good scenes to illustrate the Viscount's future travel narrative. Natural history is all the rage, so he collects specimens of plants and animals. Notably, and I swear this is true, he brings home a previously unknown species of dick-dick. That's an antelope. It's called that because it goes dick-dick. What else would you call it? Viscount Valentia is delighted with this young man, who exceeds expectations with both his drawings and his diplomatic talents. So, in 1815, the Viscount recommends Henry Salt for the appointment of Consul General in Egypt. Henry Salt arrives in Cairo in March of 1816. But what exactly is the point of a Consul General? Nowadays, the consulate is where you go to get a tourist visa. They deal in paperwork. Some consuls have found the job so uneventful they turned to, for example, writing novels. That's how Vikas Swarup wrote the book that became Slumdog Millionaire, while he was stationed in Indian consulates abroad. In America, the roles of consuls and ambassadors are often given out to major political donors as sinecures, which is totally corruption, but both parties have done that since the very beginning of the US, and it's not too rare in other countries either, so it's probably okay or whatever. But in the age of Henry Salt, the job was a mix of politics and business, and those were pretty much one and the same. The more powerful your country was, the more influential your consul was, and the larger the business opportunities. In places like Egypt, which wasn't part of the British Empire at this point, but kinda wasn't not, the British consul was sometimes the de facto most powerful person in the country. What's special about Egypt, when Salt gets the gig, can be summed up in one word: Egyptomania. The Western world suddenly wants as much of ancient Egypt as it can get its claws into. Egyptian-inspired architecture and literature are all the rage in Europe. People of every social class crowd museums to see mummies. As the British Consul General, Salt serves three masters. He will save interesting antiquities for the crown, he will compose a collection for the British Museum, and he won't forget his protector, who fancies a mummy. This is what he writes Viscount Valentia. As to sending a mummy entire, it is almost impossible, owing to the objections made by the captains of ships to carry them. There are some in Alexandria that have waited 4 years. If I can get a good head, you may depend on having it. Salt remarks in the same letter that he's finding it difficult to secure antiques. He partly blames the plague. Yes, the medieval one, the bubonic plague, the bring out your dead plague. Some among you may have noticed the date, March 1816. Mount Tambora erupted 11 months ago. The year without a summer is not stopping at blocking out sunlight, reversing entire climates, destroying harvests, and starving tens of millions to death. It also brings back a whole catalog of interesting diseases. In Egypt, people are dying en masse. Newcomers such as Salt are quarantined. But the minute he's at liberty to get out, Salt identifies another obstacle in his collecting mission. I found that Monsieur Drovetti, the quondam French consul, was in Upper Egypt, buying up everything there to complete a collection. This collection, which I have lately had an opportunity of examining, contains a great variety of curious articles, and some of extraordinary value. This Monsieur Drovetti sounds like an interesting fellow. Salt calls him the quondam French consul, meaning the former French consul, using the Latin word because he's so classy. So Drovetti is a consul who is no longer a consul. He is a French operative whose name sounds distinctly Italian. A collector of Egyptian antiques whose collection is head and shoulders above any other, and he keeps on collecting. A man who, not being a consul anymore, could go home to the dolce vita of European dignitaries, yet he chooses to stay in a country then plagued by bandits bearing crocodile skin shields, 3-inch long scorpions, wars between superpowers, and the actual frickin' plague. This, ladies and gentlemen, is our Bond villain. Who the heck is this guy? Bernardino Giovetti is his full name. He grew up in Piedmont, in the north of what is now Italy. At the time, there was no Italy, just a collection of local kingdoms. Napoleon invades Piedmont in 1798, just a few months before going to Egypt. All able-bodied men are conscripted, like it or not, into the French army. Giovetti, then 22 years old, joins their ranks. He climbs up fast, becomes the general's right-hand man, and a judge for the criminal court in Turin. He gains the confidence of two key men in Napoleon's closest circle, Murat and Talleyrand. And so it begins. In 1803, Giovetti arrives in Egypt to assist the then French consul in his business affairs. The consul in question leaves Egypt the following year. Giovetti remains in Egypt as the highest-ranking diplomatic representative of France. He's 28. For 3 years, Giovetti mans the consulate. Despite having been drafted into the French army, he is not considered French, so he can't be promoted to consul. But in 1807, his cards get reshuffled so hard that the events of a few weeks will determine not only Giovetti's entire life, but also France and Britain's influence over Egypt. For the next 30 years, the British are coming. Again. After the British and Ottomans crushed the French invasion, Egypt fell even deeper into chaos. Now it was supposed to be ruled by the Ottomans. But which Ottomans? Me, say three separate factions of the extremely decentralized Ottoman Empire. A three-way civil war breaks out between the core Ottoman Empire, the Mamluks, who are rich and powerful but are also legally classified as slaves, and the Bashi Bazouks, who are a mostly Albanian bunch of mercenaries who the Ottomans call on to fight in especially brutal conflicts, but are famously difficult to control and not all that loyal to anyone but themselves. You know how America armed the Taliban in the 80s when the USSR invaded Afghanistan, and then the Taliban successfully drove out the Soviets, and look how that turned out for America? The Bashi Bazouks were like that. So the British look at this mess and are like, fuck that, the only people they trust to rule Egypt are themselves. So they invade. Again. Now there's a fourth front in this war. Giovetti flees Alexandria as the city is promptly taken by the Expeditionary Corps of General Mackenzie Fraser. In Cairo, Giovetti stirs up the local anti-British resistance, which is something the other colonial superpower always tries to do when there's a conflict like this, and it famously always works out in their favor in the long run, right? The core Ottoman Empire can only be delighted by the return of the English, their partners in crime. Less power, less independence for Egypt means a stronger Ottoman control by proxy. But before the British invaded, the leader of the Bashi Bazouks faction, Muhammad Ali, no relation, was on the verge of winning the civil war. Muhammad Ali happens to be fighting down south at the time the Brits land in Alexandria. Giovetti urgently calls him back up north. Ali returns, defeats the British, centralizes power over Egypt, and appoints Giovetti as his special counsel. At 31 years of age, Bernardino Giovetti is the second most powerful man in Egypt. He must have been so relieved when he first met the new British consul. Henry Salt is a peacetime consigliere. Salt is mild-mannered. He loves art. He learns the language. A contemporary source remarks that Henry Salt constitutes a welcome change from the arrogant, superior British dignitaries who preceded him. Muhammad Ali likes him. He gifts Salt a horse. It must have taken all of 20 seconds for Giovetti to realize that Salt presented no danger to him, represented no competition. The same can't be said for another Englishman, of sorts, who arrives in Salt's wake. Enter the Patagonian Titan. Gian Battista Belzoni was not from Patagonia. His family was based in Padua, Italy. The other Italian in this story is working for the French, so obviously this guy is working for the British. Belzoni was not Patagonian, but he certainly was small t titanic. He stood at 6'7", or 2.1 meters. That's tall for today. That was immense for the time. Wide-shouldered and muscular, the man is built like a warship. He grew up with 13 siblings. Early on, he displays an adventurous spirit, running away from home when he's just 13. His family sends him to a school in Rome. He shows an interest in hydraulics, but he joins a monastery and studies to become a monk. That's when he first gets acquainted with archaeology. Belzoni is 20 years old when Napoleon's troops invade Italy. Unlike Giovetti, the future French consul, Belzoni doesn't fancy joining the army. Maybe he doesn't like war, or the French, or the notion that he'd be standing three heads above the next man offering an easy target. He flees the draft. We find him in the Netherlands, working as a barber, which is his father's trade. Later, in Paris, selling religious images on the streets. Then he moves to London and joins the circus. The Great Belzoni, the Titan of Patagonia, is a circus strongman. He hauls a contraption of his own design on his shoulders. Between two parallel bars, he can carry up to 11 people. But Balzoni isn't happy with simply displaying feats of strength. He embraces the latest trend in show business, phantasmagoria. In total darkness, he projects frightening images of skeletons, ghosts, and the like, together with sound effects and spooky narration. Bursts of fire explode unexpectedly. Water geysers spray in time with music. Then, of course, he hauls 11 people on his shoulders. He's one of the top ticket attractions at Astley's Amphitheater, the arena owned by the impresario Philip Astley, often considered the father of the circus. No record on whether Philip Astley has any famous descendants. In between shows, Belzoni meets his wife. Sarah Belzoni is the kind of British woman who, in a zombie apocalypse, would fix a cup of tea for the zombies. Later in life, while her husband plays in the tombs of Egyptian pharaohs, she goes on a trip to Jerusalem and dresses as a man to enter the mosques. I wish she'd written more about herself. Suffice it to say, she was the right gal for our guy. Anyway, that's Belzoni's background. We now get back to 1815. All trends peter out. Belzoni has toured Europe as the Patagonian Titan, and everyone who wants to see him has seen him. The Belzonis are broke and looking for their next adventure. They borrow some money and set out on a trip to Constantinople, today's Istanbul, with a stop in Malta along the way. In Malta, Belzoni learns that Egypt is in dire need of better pumps to irrigate their land and counteract the annual flooding of the Nile. Perfect. Belzoni fancies himself a hydraulics specialist. He did, allegedly, once study that in school. He designs a pump that would only require the use of one ox to operate, as opposed to the current four, and just half the men. Alexandria, here they come. Belzoni pitches his new pumping system to Muhammad Ali. Ali agrees to finance Belzoni's plans to build his pumps all over Egypt. They put up the first one. It only takes a few days for an Egyptian man operating the pump to seriously hurt himself. Belzoni claims the poor fellow didn't follow instructions. Either way, Ali is not amused. No more pumps for Belzoni. Exit the hydraulic specialist, pursued by a stinging lack of funds. That's when Belzoni meets Sheikh Ibrahim ibn Abdallah. His birth name? Johann Ludwig Burckhardt. This citizen of Switzerland stands out among the very first archaeology adventurers. Dressed as a native, fluent in Arabic, he became the first Westerner to set eyes upon the hidden city of Petra, in today's Jordan. He's now in Cairo, preparing his next expedition. Burckhardt and Belzoni get along like a house on fire. Burckhardt realizes Belzoni needs a break and tells him a secret. Down in Luxor, in the temple of the god Memnon, lies a monumental statue of the young god. It was too heavy and bulky for the French corps to carry it out of the temple. It could be worth a lot of money. But what, you may ask, would one do with a giant statue of the Egyptian god Memnon? Burckhardt introduces Belzoni to a man in dire need of Egyptian antiques, the British consul general, our man in Cairo, Henry Salt. Salt is, to say the least, not all that taken by the personality of the Patagonian Titan. On their first meeting, Salt turns down Belzoni's offer to go get the statue for him. But a few months later, Salt changes his mind. Perhaps he has taken the measure of how hard it is to obtain important antiques. For sure, he knows Belzoni has met Drovetti, the French consul and world-class collector of antiques, and they seem to be on friendly terms. If those two become allies, Salt will be left with crumbs. Reluctantly, Salt finances Belzoni's expedition. The former circus strongman, ex-monk, ex-barber, ex-engineer, reincarnates as an Egyptologist. 100 years later, an American writer, Henry Beston, publishes The Book of Gallant Vagabonds. It tells the life stories of four adventurers, Belzoni among them. Henry Beston isn't too particular with dates and facts, but where he is clearly superior to any contemporary account is turn of phrase. As Belzoni departs on his first expedition to Luxor, Beston writes, "In the dark underworld of vanished deities, the animal-headed gods of Egypt, the cow Hathor, the cat Pasht, and the jackal Anubis stir in their ancient dreams, for the first of the awakeners of their civilization is setting foot beside the Nile." Indeed, on June 30th, 1816, off goes Belzoni. Alongside him travel his wife Sarah and a manservant he brought from the UK, an Irish lad by the name of James Curtin, all of 13 years old. The party travels on donkeys' backs. Where they're going, there are no roads. It's a harrowing trip south to Luxor in the desert summer. It's probably cooler than it would usually have been because of Tambora, but it's still pretty damn hot. About 500 miles or 800 kilometers of sand and sun and not much else. But whenever he can, Belzoni stops to admire monuments of ancient Egypt. He describes, he draws, he compares. From time to time, he will suggest that his predecessors got it wrong. Somehow, in the few weeks between meeting Salt and leaving Cairo, he has absorbed every single account by every explorer, French, British, and ancient Greek, who came before him. Egypt lasted so long that there were even ancient Egyptian archaeologists studying the monuments built by their own civilization many dynasties ago. Belzoni pitches his tent like locals do, among the ruins of ancient temples. No better way to get some shade in the daytime, some heat at night, and walls against the sandy wind. He starts dressing like a native, with billowing pants, an embroidered vest, and the tallest turban west of Istanbul. He finally arrives in Thebes, one of ancient Egypt's former capitals, surrounded today by the modern city of Luxor. A 20-foot-tall, 7-ton statue isn't exactly hard to locate. The bust of the young god Memnon lies on its back near its former bottom half. Belzoni describes it as, quote, apparently smiling on me at the thought of being taken to England. Sure, it can't be worse than going with the French, who had dug a hole in the left shoulder in order to insert a mine. They would have been happy with just the head, easier to transport. At the very last minute, someone realized that the explosion might blow the face off. Now that we found Memnon, what are we going to do with it? From Cairo, Belzoni has brought 14 poles, 4 ropes of palm leaves, and 4 rollers. The contraption he ends up with must have been extremely close to how the ancient Egyptians moved their bulkier stones. Of course he can't do it alone. He's bearing a letter from Muhammad Ali, allowing him to ask the local ruler for workers. He'll pay them, treat them decently, sounds straightforward enough. For the first time in a very long series of times this would happen, Belzoni shows up at the temple expecting 80 to 100 men and finds himself alone. What gives? Local chiefs need to assert their authority. Over their people, over Belzoni, over their enemies in the next village, over even the national government. Belzoni is slow at understanding their culture of gift-giving, and Salt is slow at sending said presents. As for the workers, they're farmers. They're used to working in their fields, not a rendezvous at a fixed hour to move ginormous stones. Also, it is, well, hot. There's no other word for it. This is the end of July. 1816 was the year without a summer, but in the desert, yeah, it's still summer. You'd think Belzoni, being Italian, would fare a bit better than your average Brit. Nope, he gets such a bad heat stroke that he has to stop working for days. He comments that, what is singular, Mrs. Belzoni enjoyed tolerable health all the time. On the other hand, she's not trying to move a monumental statue with palm tree trunks. And suddenly, Belzoni realizes the clock is ticking. In a matter of weeks, the Nile is going to flood all the land around the temple. Meanwhile, word reaches Drovetti that Belzoni is finding monuments on behalf of Henry Salt, and therefore the British. Drovetti is furious. Belzoni resolves to rush it. Using 2 poles as levers, his crew manages to put the statue on a makeshift cart. The next day, to the workers' amazement, young Memnon moves 50 yards forward and out of his temple. They get the statue on the road. But they're not going back to Cairo. The trip is such an endeavor and a financial commitment that Belzoni needs to make the most of it. There's still more treasure to find here in Upper Egypt, which is what the south of Egypt is called because it's up the Nile. Suspecting Drovetti's men might be interested in stealing Memnon, Belzoni digs a giant hole in the sand and hides the statue in there. Then he pushes south. The road is a daily challenge. The Nile waters get to the trails, the donkeys sink in the loose sands. Ramadan starts and the workers toil all day without food. A local chief, in Drovetti's pocket, loses his temper at Belzoni so badly he tries to strangle him and draws his sword. That doesn't end well for the sword. The party finally obtains a boat to sail up the Nile, and they very nearly sink. Belzoni falls ill again, bleeding from the nose and mouth. Yet, nothing seems to dampen his adventurous spirit. When he had met Drovetti back in Cairo, Drovetti had, and I quote, given him permission to retrieve a stone sarcophagus that had proved too bulky to move. The man thinks he owns the place. Belzoni decides to give the sarcophagus a try. Locating the tomb where it's buried, quote, we took out the greater part of our clothes and, each having a candle, advanced through a cavity in the rock. In some passages, we were obliged to creep on the ground like crocodiles. I perceived that we were at a great distance from the entrance, and the way was so intricate that I depended entirely on the 2 Arabs guiding me to conduct us out again. Suddenly, a deafening noise of falling rocks startles Belzoni. His interpreter, who was walking ahead of him with a local man, screams, "Oh my god, I am done for!" A profound silence ensues. Belzoni, not knowing exactly where they are, resolves to get out and get help. "I told my man to show me the way out again, but staring at me like an idiot, he said he did not know the road. It was a complete labyrinth. By this time, our candles had diminished considerably, and I feared that if we did not get out soon, we should have to remain in the dark." At last, he reaches a dead end. Belzoni keeps his head screwed on straight and methodically explores every corridor. Finally, he finds the exit, where his interpreter awaits. The guy found another exit, an exit the Egyptians knew about all along. They had planned to lose Belzoni in the labyrinth and ask for money to lead him out again. Their plan was foiled by stones falling from the ceiling onto the interpreter and his guide. They weren't injured, but they were terrified and dashed to safety. The sarcophagus, Belzoni writes, was 100 yards from the large entrance. Did the locals think of that little ploy themselves, or did someone put them up to it? Someone who gave Belzoni permission he didn't know he needed to go into this tomb, perhaps? On his way back to Luxor, Memnon in tow, Belzoni makes a halt on the river island of Philae, the so-called Pearl of the Nile. There is a fine granite obelisk there that would look good in England. He can't take it there now. The Nile is too low for the boat to pass a waterfall with the obelisk on board. He settles on stones engraved with fine hieroglyphs. Belzoni strikes a deal with the Aga, the ruler of Aswan. It is agreed that Belzoni takes possession of the obelisk in the name of His Britannic Majesty's Consul General in Cairo. He will return to Philae to get the obelisk when the Nile permits. In Luxor, Belzoni crosses paths with two agents of Drovetti. They mock his statue of Memnon. They declare it worthless, pretending that's the reason the French left it there. Their parting words are to warn Belzoni against local chiefs. "They'll cut your throat," they say. Belzoni tells him that he is greatly obliged for the information. Writing his travel account, Belzoni so far has been remarkably composed, patient, and tenacious. But there he loses it. "Here, reader, was the beginning of those discoveries which have caused me so much trouble, not from the exertion and arduous labor required in these researches, but in the atrocious persecution they have drawn on me, from malice, jealousy, and envy. I have further enterprises in view which I hope will convince my adversaries that their persecution has had no effect on me. Had I not been determined to stand, like a pyramid defying the wind, against all their numerous attacks which poured on me like a torrent, I should not have been able to proceed." Our pyramid-sized fellow appears undeterred indeed, for he starts a new excavation site in Karnak, again in the Luxor area. He finds an alley bordered on both sides by sphinxes, and a life-size statue, possibly of Amun, remarkably well-preserved. After much palaver, Belzoni finds someone who owns a boat willing to take his findings to Cairo. But when the boat arrives, the captain refuses to take charge of the antiquities. Two of Drovetti's agents had told the captain he would lose his boat on account of Memnon being so heavy and would not be compensated for it. He then learns that the engraved stones he gathered at Philae, further south, are not on their way either. The French agents have once more made sure no boats agreed to take them. Belzoni manages to scramble together a donkey caravan to bring them to Luxor where he's working. But when his treasures arrive, you can hear Belzoni's heart break. The stones have been mutilated and rendered useless. Someone went at invaluable antiques with a hammer. Wonder who put them up to that? Belzoni somehow finds it in himself to keep digging at Karnak. Luckily for him, the French make a big mistake. They promise valuable presents to the town chief as long as he assures to halt Belzoni's progress. But when the valuable presents arrive, turns out it's just a few jars of anchovies and olives. The chief goes ballistic. Belzoni jumps at the opportunity. He makes a present of the last of his tobacco, coffee, and ammunition. Penniless, coffeeless, unarmed and sunburnt, but successful at last, Belzoni, his wife, his Irish lad, and his stones, along with young Memnon and his smile, promptly arrive in Cairo. Shortly afterward, the collection of treasures sails away to Britain. Where's Belzoni? Not on board. He's still in Cairo, and he wants to go back south. There are financial reasons pushing his decision, but from his writings it's also clear that he's been bitten by the bug of Egyptology. There is a special hubris that springs from bringing to light the homes of ancient gods, the repositories of all-powerful kings, the mesmerizing art of a long-gone culture. Belzoni has tasted it, and he wants more. Henry Salt, as ever in need of antiques, agrees to finance a small-sized treasure fishing expedition. From day one, it's a race. As Belzoni is negotiating paperwork for his boat, he spots two of Drovetti's men. The next day, they're gone. Belzoni learns that they have started out on a forced march to Thebes. Belzoni rushes south as fast as he can, but he's too late. The men have made away with four sphinxes, and asserted their rights to Belzoni's former digging sites. In Luxor, Belzoni starts looking around Gurna, a village on the west bank of the Nile, reputed for its tombs. Today, 200 years later, a controversy rages between the government of Egypt, which wants to preserve the tombs in the area, and the villagers of Gurna, who live in modern houses right on top of the decaying tombs, most of which have long since been raided by locals and foreigners alike, and don't want to leave. But at the time, there was still a lot to find in Gurna, as long as you had a strong stomach. This is Belzoni exploring a tomb. I sought a resting place, found one, and contrived to sit, but when my weight bore on the body of an Egyptian, it crushed like a bandbox, meaning a box that a hat comes in. I naturally had recourse to my hands to sustain my weight, but they found no better support, so that I sunk altogether among the broken mummies, with a crash of bones, rags, and wooden cases. Every step I took, I crushed a mummy in some part or other. I could not pass without putting my face in contact with that of some decayed Egyptian. I could not avoid being covered with bones, legs, arms, and heads rolling from above. There were so many mummies back then. Hell, there are still lots of mummies. It's difficult to overstate how common it is to find mummies in Egypt. We associate mummification with pharaohs and other high-ranking people, but for most of ancient Egypt's history, everyone was mummified. And their pets, too. It's estimated a total of 70 million people were mummified over the 2,000 years that Egypt practiced mummification. They were so abundant, when Mark Twain went to Egypt in the 1860s, he wrote that the trains, instead of burning coal, burn mummies. They do not, and never did. That was just Mark Twain being Mark Twain. But they could have! The early 19th century wave of Egyptomania inspired a trade in mummies for paint. Thousands of mummies were ground up to make a brown pigment favored by artists in Europe. You can still buy a paint color called mummy brown, but it's not made from mummies anymore. You might have heard of the other use of mummies. Back before that, in the medieval days, Arab physicians had a medicinal substance they called mumia. Europeans mistranslated this word as mummy, and came to believe that the Arabs were slurping ground-up Egyptian mummies as medicine. So they said, what the hell, we should try that! And pretty soon you could buy mumia in European apothecaries made from ground-up mummies. The real stuff, which was made of tar, also separately made its way into Europe, and most apothecaries weren't aware that it was the same thing as mumia because Europeans called the real stuff piss asphalt. The Oxford English Dictionary notes that it was also called, quote, mineral pitch, Jew's pitch, or in the Old Testament, slime. Mumia made from mummies was never a common remedy, and Europeans realized they'd mistranslated it by the Renaissance. Mummies are rare because we ate them is not, in fact, true. First of all, large-scale industrial use of mummies did not start happening until after Napoleon invaded Egypt and set off the scramble for artifacts this episode is about. They were definitely used for all kinds of things after that. By the mid-19th century, mummies were being sold as fertilizer. There are a few real cases of them being used for fuel, just not as the typical fuel for the trains the British built in Egypt. But second of all, mummies still aren't rare. There are still, to this day, millions of mummies that have yet to be dug up. Anyway, it's 1817, and Belzoni is locked in a race to plunder Egypt's treasures before Drovetti can. Belzoni has several excavation sites going on at the same time. Then, it all screeches to a stop. The ruler of Upper Egypt, the part where Luxor is, produces a decree forbidding anyone to sell antiques to the English or to work for them. This was not out of some high-minded interest in historical preservation. In all the discourse about how Europe stole sacred artifacts, we forget how, at the time, the Europeans often admired the history of the places they colonized more than the locals did. A lot of artifacts were sold to European powers by local leaders who saw them as worthless, or, later, as a way to make money off the foolish Europeans who want to buy up all the old junk we have lying around for some reason.
Why on earth would a museum put a mummy in it?
It's a bitter pill to swallow, but a lot of the foreign artifacts in the British Museum probably survive today only because they are in the British Museum. This decree by the leader of Upper Egypt was no exception. He didn't want the artifact for Egyptians. The decree concludes, "On the contrary, it is hereby ordered that everything that may be found shall be sold to the party of Mr. Drovetti." At this point, though, Belzoni has gathered enough to fill up another boat, as large as the one in his first expedition. He orders a mud wall to be built around his findings and covers them with earth. He writes to Salt, who doesn't fully understand the Drovetti problem, or does not care. Salt's letters indicate that he would very much like Belzoni to stop making such a fuss and antagonizing both the French and local chiefs. Now, Belzoni has another ace up his sleeve. His friend Burckhardt, the Swiss explorer who rediscovered Petra, entrusted him with not one but two secrets. The first was the statue of young Memnon, which he successfully sent to London. The second? Burckhardt has identified the location of the mythical temple of Ipsambul. Down south, near the border with Sudan, in a place so remote and so inaccessible that most people believe it nearly imaginary, a castle in the air. Sadly, Burckhardt has just passed away. Belzoni writes a moving obituary for his friend. He puts his trust and bets the last of his funds on Burckhardt's indications. He finds the spot. It's a stretch of desert, nondescript in all directions. Belzoni believes that the entrance to the temple lies under at least 35 feet of sand. That's a lot of sand. And when you remove sand from one side of a hole, it pours down the other. From then on, it's the usual. Punitive heat, political maneuvers, Ramadan starting, desert sand not cooperating. For bonus points, the local people refuse to work for money. Why? Because they don't use money. Instead, they barter with dates and salt. Once Belzoni proves that you can exchange coins for food, the local chief grabs all the workers' wages for himself. An arrangement is found. Belzoni's understanding of hydraulics help him empty the ocean with a teaspoon. I mean, clear tons and tons of sand from a hole in the desert. And then, carved into the rock, four colossal statues of King Ramses II stare down the desert sands. They're seated, wearing the double crown of Upper and Lower Egypt. The sunrise slowly turns the stone from gray to gold. The statues seem to radiate infinite power, becoming one with the sun god whose temple they guard. When you look at the entrance of Ipsambul, which today we call Abu Simbel, you may want to remember that it used to be covered in sand all the way up to the top of the rock, and that it came to light thanks to a circus actor and his crew of unskilled workers using woven baskets and palm tree trunks. In 22 days. On the 22nd day of excavations, Gian Battista Belzoni is the first man of the modern era, and likely the first Westerner ever, to pass under the gaze of the kings and step into the Temple of Abu Simbel. It took a giant to appease the giants. Belzoni returns to Gurna, where he spots Drovetti's men. Belzoni has no desire to work near them, so he pushes on to the valley of Beban el Maluk. Good idea, this. Belzoni has noticed how the ancient Egyptians always set the lintel stones over entrances in a specific way. That's helpful when you're looking for entrances, as most are covered in either sand or fallen rocks. After a few interesting excavations and quite a lot of mummies, Belzoni finds a structure he really likes. The stones on top are arranged so that when it rained, a waterfall would mask the entrance. His workmen tell him there is no way there could be a tomb in there. Right. Belzoni has the stones removed. He finds a corridor and advances inside. But soon he is stalled by an ingenious trick. The way forward has been plastered over and painted with hieroglyphs to look like the other walls. By the light of his candle, Belzoni finally notices a 2-foot aperture. Having learned nothing from his possibly arranged brush with death in the labyrinth, he crawls. Even before reaching the mortuary chamber, he knows from the quality of the art covering every inch of the walls and ceilings that it is a tomb of the First Order. He names the rooms he traverses. The Room of Beauties, the Hall of Pillars, the Room of Mysteries. The vibrant greens, blues, and ochres have not aged one bit since they were painted. No one has been in here for thousands of years. At the heart of the labyrinth, he finds the mortuary room. The ceiling is painted blue, depicting a night sky. It is designed to incite the soul of the pharaoh to escape to the sky and attain immortality beside the stars. Ladder-shaped hieroglyphs on the walls call on the soul of the king. Ascend! Leave this body and climb! for at the center of the room lies the sarcophagus. And if you're thinking of a wooden box, think again. In Belzoni's description, it is a sarcophagus of the finest oriental alabaster, 9 feet 5 inches long. The craftsmanship on the milky white stone is so fine that, in Belzoni's words, it is transparent when a light is placed inside of it. It is minutely sculptured within and without with several hundred figures. A breathtaking masterpiece. This is the tomb of the great pharaoh Seti I, the father of Ramses II. This is the moment where Giambattista Belzoni becomes immortal. Maybe. Or maybe not. At this time, I received several journals from Europe and found, to my great surprise, that all my former discoveries and labors had been published under the names of other people, while mine was not even mentioned. Growing more and more disgusted each day, Belzoni turns to looking for new discoveries. But once you've brought to light a whole temple and found the intact tomb of a great pharaoh, what's left? What could be better than that? A pyramid, that's what. Inside a pyramid runs an incredibly cramped and confusing labyrinth. Some corridors climb so steeply you need a rope to hold onto. They lead to a room in the center, to the mortuary chamber. So, that's where the pharaoh's mummy is, you would think. Show me the mummy. Well, not necessarily. As far back as there have been tombs harboring valuables, there have been tomb robbers. Yes, since ancient Egypt. Some tombs were probably robbed just months after their residents were buried. To protect them from robbers, mummies of kings and queens were frequently taken from their burial chambers in the pyramids and unceremoniously packed, sometimes 12 to a sarcophagus, in a tomb far, far away. Before long, pharaohs stopped building pyramids altogether. When the Colosseum was built in ancient Rome, the pyramids of Giza were already as old as the Colosseum is today. Henry Salt suggests Belzoni should team up with Captain Giambattista Caviglia. An Italian working for Salt, who happens to share Belzoni's first name, Caviglia has started excavating the Great Sphinx. The Sphinx's head has always been above the sands, but by then the rest of it was buried. At present, Caviglia is looking for the mortuary chamber in Cheops, the Great Pyramid at Giza. Belzoni turns down the offer. He wants a pyramid of his own, a good one, with a mummy and treasures and the attached prestige. And, don't you know, Pharaoh Khafre was buried in a very pretty pyramid just next door. When Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, asked about the entrance to Khafre's pyramid, he was told there was none. Belzoni thinks Herodotus isn't making sense. The pyramid was already over 1,000 years old by the time Herodotus wrote about it anyway. There has to be a way to get in there. He learns that his nemesis Drovetti has gathered authorizations and funds to basically brute force his way into Khafre. Drovetti intends to attack the pyramid with battering rams and explosives. Good thing they didn't have tanks back then. Even so, Belzoni likes his chances. He admits he doesn't have the classical education of his predecessors, but he reckons he makes up for it with his powers of observation. He's learned a lot about Egyptian architecture in the past 2 years. He grabs a tent and goes camping in front of Khafre. Every day for a month, he meticulously observes the stones circling the pyramid. When he thinks he may have found a telltale sign, he gets the paperwork in order. He hires teenagers to start digging, as he can't afford to pay an adult's salary. There is, indeed, a passage. But it's a strange one. It's precariously built, with giant stones in the ceiling holding merely by the corners, threatening to fall at any minute. That's not how ancient Egyptians worked. Also, Belzoni reflects it must have taken incredible strength to dig that passage into those 5-ton stones. He will soon realize why. What he's found is not the entrance. It's where unknown previous explorers, possibly 14th century Arabs, showed their love for historical monuments with industrial amounts of gunpowder. Belzoni has wormed his way into plenty of rickety tombs before, but he doesn't trust this passage to hold if he walks in. However, Belzoni does not give up. Back to his tent he goes. He resumes his daily stone watch. And then, he finds something. On March 2nd, 1818, Giambattista Belzoni enters the Khafre Pyramid. In a little under 2 years, to the amazement and genuine consternation of the academic world, the circus strongman has made 3 extraordinary discoveries: a major temple, a major pharaoh's tomb, and the entrance to a major pyramid, which everyone thought for millennia didn't exist. Then, how come the next line in this story is not, "He became very famous and reasonably wealthy, returned to London amidst much fanfare, and spent the rest of his life traveling the world with his Sarah and his Irish lad, occasionally replenishing his bank account through the conference circuit"? How come the next line is more like, In under 5 years, he would be dead, lying penniless and alone on the floor of a hut in an African village, forgotten by all. You may assume Drovetti is involved. Much as it hurts to admit it, that part is not entirely Drovetti's fault. He does get an A for effort, though. After the pyramid, Belzoni launches on a third expedition. Of course he does. He goes to Egypt's coast along the Red Sea, new territory for him, and identifies the precise location of the ancient city of Berenice, founded by the Ptolemaic kings during the era Greeks ruled Egypt. This is a huge milestone for ancient world scholars. On his way, Belzoni stops at the island of Philae on the Nile. There he finds he still likes the granite obelisk he had noticed on his first voyage. That will prove the stone that broke the donkey's back. Bringing back the obelisk to Cairo is an ordeal of galactic magnitude. Reading between the lines of Belzoni's accounts, Drovetti's men got physical trying to stop him removing the obelisk. Some sources even say Belzoni grabbed an Egyptian dude working for Drovetti by the ankles, lifted him bodily and whirled round, using the dude as a rotor blade to make way. Maybe, maybe not, but weapons were definitely drawn. Drovetti pays local chiefs to stop Belzoni and pays boat captains to deny him passage. When Belzoni finally proceeds to lift the obelisk onto a boat, the damn thing slips and sinks in the harbor, to the great hilarity of Drovetti's men watching the scene. Lifting it back out takes up the last of Belzoni's spirit. He resolves to leave Egypt for good. But before that, he demands justice. Drovetti has been trying to ruin him for years, in the pay of the French government. Authorities promise him a fair trial. That would be a drawing room with representatives of the French and British authorities, as well as the Egyptian governorate. But he'll have to wait a year and a half for the trial to happen. A year and a half doing basically nothing, waiting for the people in charge to all be back in Cairo at the same time. Of course, when the trial finally takes place, it's a sham. Belzoni expects Henry Salt to defend him. He doesn't. He has his own interests to protect. Drovetti is exonerated of any wrongdoing. Enough is enough. Belzoni decides to bypass Salt and sell his antiques directly. He sells a few statues to the French director of national museums. The obelisk goes to a British aristocrat. Crucially, he sells the translucent alabaster sarcophagus of Seti to John Sloane, a private collector in London. Salt will never forgive him, but at this point, Belzoni doesn't give a flying duck. He leaves Egypt. Forever. In London, Belzoni is once more, sing it with me, penniless. With some of the antiques he brought back and his intact sense of showmanship, he puts together an exhibition on ancient Egypt, an exhibition the likes of which no one has seen before. Belzoni's exhibition, dubbed the Egyptian Tomb, opens in Piccadilly in the spring of 1821. Two rooms recreate parts of the tomb of Seti I, complete with frescoes and sculptures. As you walk through entrance doors guarded by Isis and Osiris, Belzoni would welcome you, dressed in the exotic attire he wore on his expeditions. Then you would find yourself inside Seti's tomb, meticulously reproduced. You would try your best, despite the absolutely packed crowd, to move from wall to wall. You would admire, quote, idols, coins, mummies, scarabi. I think that's the plural of scarab. Articles of dress and adornment, lacrimatories, and a splendid mass of papyrus. According to Belzoni, who lights the whole thing with oil lamps and candles. You might even come across an image of Sarah Belzoni reading the Bible in the company of a mummy. Belzoni calls it his real phantasmagoria, harking back to his circus days where he used magic lanterns and sound effects to plunge spectators into a world of ghosts and skeletons. Contrary to the British Museum, where antiques are displayed in stark white rooms for you to appreciate the art, Belzoni's tomb, as it's known, feels real. If that isn't the first ever instance of immersive entertainment, I don't know what it is. It's a rare moment in Victorian England when Londoners of all classes and ages contemplate art, death, and foreign cultures, side by side. The exhibition is a roaring success. It travels to Paris. People write articles, and songs, and poetry about it. Belzoni finds glory and recognition at last, but he can't stand still. He has to be out digging things up. The Association for Promoting the Discovery of the Interior Parts of Africa, which is a name and a half even then, so everyone just called it the Africa Association, was founded in London back in 1788. It endeavored to find the source of the River Niger and the legendary city of gold, Timbuktu. As colonists of the time go, these guys really weren't the worst. They thought it was a major failure of the Age of Enlightenment to know less about Africa than the ancient Greeks did and to leave the African continent almost totally uncharted. They didn't see themselves as trying to civilize the savages. They believe, at this point, that there are advanced civilizations in interior Africa. Perhaps even by then, some of them believed in the legend of Prester John. As such, they financed at least 8 expeditions. Right before Belzoni, their hopes rested on the turban of our unfortunate friend Burckhardt. Back in Cairo in 1817, Burckhardt was days away from departing on this new adventure when dysentery struck him dead. Belzoni is ready for Burckhardt's ghost to pass him the baton. Belzoni boards a British ship and sails for Benin. His travel companion is an English fellow named John Houston. On November 22, 1823, Belzoni makes landfall and starts toward the interior of the country. Days pass and Houston worries he's not hearing back from Belzoni. He goes after his friend, asks around. Finally, he finds him in the river village of Gwato, today known as Ugothon, in Nigeria. But this is not a happy reunion. Belzoni is dying, most likely of dysentery. On December 3rd, 1823, Gian Battista embarks on his last expedition, heading for the kingdom of the dead he was already so familiar with. Belzoni's legacy is a controversial one. For many, he remains the great Belzoni, the atypical explorer, the Italian Indiana Jones. On top of his discoveries, modern researchers credit his London exhibition with igniting a popular passion for Egypt and shaping how modern museums represent Egyptian art. Egyptologists of the academic variety are rarely so enthusiastic. Belzoni's methods were on the rustic side. Today, the British Museum labels him a, quote, excavator. Belzoni never tried to dynamite pyramids like another Italian we know, but he was no stranger to the occasional battering ram. He broke the base of 2 columns in the Temple of Memnon to get the statue out. To copy hieroglyphs, he used a process called squeeze, pressing wet wax or plaster against the reliefs. When they dried, the colors got pulled away and the reliefs were damaged. Worse still, Belzoni's removal of the stones above Seti's tomb, the stones that channeled a waterfall masking the entrance, led to the tomb being repeatedly flooded by the rains. Also, by the way, Belzoni lived inside that tomb, for weeks, with his wife. Hindsight is a beautiful thing. We know today how fragile these monuments are, and we approach them with delicacy. When Belzoni roamed the desert sands, Egyptology as a science was not 20 years old. Archaeology was seen as a great treasure hunt. As bad as Belzoni's methods were, Giovedi's were worse. And as for the Egyptians, we are not going to open the nuclear can of worms that is the return of antiques, Egyptian or otherwise, to their countries of origin. But I can't help but remark that none of the parties in our story are pure as the driven snow. Egypt at the time had no use for its historical monuments. The country needed money, diplomacy, peace, and independence, both from Western and Middle Eastern empires. Muhammad Ali was all too happy to let the Westerners take whatever stones they fancied. They fueled the economy. Before Europeans even arrived, Egyptians of the time had been using the fallen stones from pyramids and temples to build factories. Inside temples, they'd put up tents and kept their cattle. In Alexandria, the ruins of the majestic lighthouse, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, were used as a quarry for centuries. Want some high-quality stone for a building project? Lop it off the lighthouse. And I'm not saying Europe's any better. That's also why the Colosseum in Rome looks the way it does. There's a lot of old buildings in Rome built with marble chopped right off the Colosseum. You can admire Seti's alabaster sarcophagus in Sir John Sloane's museum in London. Entrance is free. If at all possible, book a candlelight tour. The reason the sarcophagus is not on display at the British Museum is that the museum turned it down. Too pricey. Architect John Sloane was all too happy to pay Belzoni the asking price of £2,000. He pierced a hole in the back of his house to bring in what he knew would be the centerpiece of his collection. The British Museum drove a hard bargain. £2,000 is the price they paid for the entirety of Henry Salt's first collection, and by collection we mean a full ship packed with antiques. For his second collection, they rejected Salt's offer of £600 per year. The French snatched it for £10,000 in 1826, almost a million today, a few months before Salt's death in Alexandria, at the age of just 47. White people didn't live long in hot places in those days. Giovedi, unsurprisingly, fared pretty well financially. France refused the exorbitant price he asked for his first collection, so he sold it to the Italians. It forms the backbone of Turin's Egyptian Museum. His second collection went to the Louvre, and his last adorns the fantastic Egyptian Museum in Berlin. Sarah Belzoni survived her husband by 43 years. She tried to revive Belzoni's exhibition in 1825, but it was a flop. Drowning in debt from the couple's travels, she had to sell their Egyptian collection. She petitioned the crown for a pension, unsuccessfully. It took 25 years for her supporters to secure for her a yearly pension of £100. She then moved to the island of Jersey, between England and France, where she is buried. Sadly, she isn't lying beside her husband, Gian Battista. Belzoni, on his deathbed in Nigeria, entrusted John Houston with his wedding ring and a love letter to his wife. Houston then buried him at the foot of a majestic tree outside the village and marked the spot with a long, emotional inscription. 40 years later, an explorer looking for Belzoni's final resting place found the tree, but there was nothing there. No one knows where Belzoni is today. Perhaps being taken by grave robbers is a fitting end for someone who spent his life as basically a fancy, socially sanctioned grave robber. But I might have another idea. If you are lucky enough to travel to Egypt, you can visit Seti's tomb, down in the valley of Bab el Maluk. It remains the most strikingly decorated tomb we've uncovered, and is sometimes open to visitors. A memorable experience. And who knows? If you look close enough, in the shadows of the pillars, under the star-studded dome, you just might catch a glimpse of the Awakener of Pharaohs, the Patagonian Titan, the explorer who never quit.
Love.